take your Bible, smartphone, tablet, and find your way to Exodus chapter 1. If this is your first time with us this morning, or if you missed last week we kicked off a study in the Old Testament book of Exodus, and we talked about why study Exodus, but I know that still is a kind of a thing that you could be thinking about, but I mean, because you think Exodus, like, what does Exodus have to do with what's going on in the world today? What does Exodus have to do with the problems in my marriage? What does Exodus have to do with the struggles I'm having with my kids? What does Exodus have to do with the problems in my workplace, or the disappointments that I face, or the difficult financial issues I have no answer for, or the discouragement that I feel, or this hole that I kind of feel stuck in, and I don't know how to get out? Exodus. Are you kidding me? Why Exodus? Well, for one really good reason that we didn't talk about last week, but this week I want to, and that is the book of Exodus is ultimately about God. It is ultimately about God. In the book of Exodus, the second part of a five-part story, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, in the book of Exodus, God is making himself known as the God who rules over the nations and redeems his people. Exodus reveals God to us as the God who rules over the nation and redeems his people. And all through this book, you hear this phrase repeated over and over again, and that is this: and they will know that I am the Lord. And that is said to God's people Israel, and it is said about the Egyptians. In fact, it wouldn't be an overstatement to say that in one sense, God's great purpose all through Scripture is to make himself known. The point being is that God wants us to know who he is and what he's up to in the world. And one reason is because a right view of God directly impacts every circumstance we face in life and every emotion that we feel. Seeing God for who he is really shapes who you are, and it informs how we are to live our lives every day. A couple weeks back, I gave you a quote by a man named A.W. Tozier. One of the greatest quotes from him, he says this: what comes to your mind when you think about God is the most important thing about you. What comes into your mind, what pops into your mind when you think about God is the most important thing about you. Now, here's why. Because think about this. If the first sentences that pop into your mind when you face a difficulty, if the first sentences were things like, God is with me and God is for me, even though I don't feel him always, I know he's with me and for me. God is a promise-keeping God. He will do what he says he will do. God is a saving God, a rescuing God, and he's always working for my good, always working to turn bad into good, always working to set me free from the things that weigh me down, like anxiety and guilt and shame and regret and anger and bitterness or some habitual sin or an addiction, whatever, you fill in the blank, whatever. God is working to save you from the things that oppress you. What if in your mind, you know, this God is always with me, God keeps his promises, God's saving, God is powerful. He's a powerful God, so nothing can hinder God's saving work in the world around me, and nothing can hinder God's purpose for my life. He has the power to do what he promised. So if those truths are the first things that come into your mind when you think about God and you face some difficulty, I mean, think about this. How much more confident would you be? How much more hope would you have? What would happen to guilt and shame and worry and regret? What would happen in your marriage? What would happen at work? What would happen at school, in your finances? What would happen when you find yourself in some conflict with another person if you knew for certain that God was working in that difficult situation for your good? For your good. Now, listen, how you think about God is the most important thing about you. And all the truths about God that I just mentioned and more are embedded in the Exodus story. Exodus gives us a right understanding of who God is and what he's like, and when, as we talked about last week, when we turn what we learn about God into praise, that gives us the confidence, the hope, the assurance that we need to lean into God's greatness and grace as we navigate life in this broken world. Why study Exodus? You're going to see God's story in Exodus. You'll see your story in Exodus. You'll see the gospel story in Exodus. You'll see how God is working to set his people free so they can live free under his rulership. So last week, we retraced God's story through Genesis, the first part of God's story of redemption. And again, if you're your first time here or you missed last week, I invite you to go online and watch it or listen to it. It's absolutely free. You can do that. But you'll learn the backstory of how God had been working in the world up to this point in time, how God created the world, how he called and chose Abraham and his descendants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Joseph, to be his treasured family. You'll learn how the children of Jacob, or children of Israel, came to live in Egypt rather than in the land of Canaan, which was the land promised to them by that God promised Abraham and his descendants. And you'll learn how Joseph saved his family and all Egypt from a great famine, and you'll learn how that God took this family of 70 people and grew them into a nation of over a million people, the nation of Israel, which brings us to chapter 1, verse 8. Chapter 1, verse 8. Now, there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. A new king who didn't know how Joseph saved Egypt from being destroyed by a great worldwide famine. A new king who didn't know the promises of a previous Pharaoh that he had made to Joseph and Jacob to protect and provide for the Jewish people. And verse 9, and he said to his people, behold, the children of Israel, the people of Israel, are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they might join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore, the Egyptians set taskmasters over them to oppress them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses, but the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel, so they ruthlessly, violently made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service. In mortar and brick, and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. Now, I want to do a little side note here, because there's lots of irony in this story, and all through the Old Testament, for that matter, that we're going to see this morning. But the irony here is that the very land that had been given to them, the best of the land in the land of Goshen, the very place they saw as their place of rescue and hope and rest and success and security, that land 400 years later turned against them. And now they are considered to be enemies of the state. Now they are going to be slaves in that land. Now they're going to be beaten in that land. Now all the rights and privileges they once had was taken from them. And that should serve as a warning to us. And that warning is this: don't put your hope in what you have or what you had or where you live. Don't put your hope in things that can be taken away from you. Put your hope in God, who cannot be taken away. Put your hope in who you have and whose you are that cannot be taken away. Now, this happens all the time to every one of us, myself included. We go through life and we tend to end up finding our happiness and our significance and our security in our jobs, in our titles, in our bank accounts, in the things that we possess, in our life goals, in our marriages, in our families, with our kids, and even in our country. And unfortunately, in this life, all of those things can be taken away from you. All those things can be lost. And when that job is lost, or it doesn't come through the way that you had hoped, when that thing that we love is taken away, when a spouse leaves or is lost, when the economy nosedives and your IRA takes a hit, as Egypt begins to exert more control over our lives, as we see what seems to be the world spinning out of control, if your hope is in the best that we used to have but no longer have, watch out. Because if your hope is in anything other than God and His Word, you will end up disappointed, bitter, or worse. Don't anchor your hope in things you can lose, but Anchor your hope in God because you can never lose Him. Don't put your hope in the way things used to be. Don't put your hope in a political party or a political leader thinking that that man or that woman will be some kind of savior who will lead us out of darkness and back into light. No, put your hope, your confidence in God and God alone, because God is working out His purposes in our world today, and nothing can stop Him from doing as He has planned. Israel finds herself in the best of the land, but it's that very land that's turning on them and enslaving them, but it's going to get worse, much worse. Verse 15. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shifra and the other Puah, he said, "When you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it's a son, you shall kill him, but if it's a daughter, she shall live." But the midwives feared God. Circle, highlight, underline, the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this? You let all the male children live." And the midwives said, "Oh, no, Pharaoh, no. The Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are more vigorous and they give birth before the midwife comes." Now, this is so good. It's like they're saying, "Pharaoh, Egyptian women are soft. They lay around on couches eating grapes with some eunuch Nubian slave fanning the sweat off their foreheads. But slave women out in the quarry, Pharaoh, I mean, they're like, oh, contraction, plop, baby. Just like right there. I mean, hand me another brick. Somebody take care of the baby. I mean, they're out there. That's what it's like." And so I'm not sure Pharaoh's buying this, though. Now, by the way, you know most Sunday mornings that we teach through whole books of the Bible, like we're doing right now. And we believe that the God of history chose to tell His story in these 66 books of the Bible. So we teach the story the way He gave it to us. And even though the books of the Bible are thousands of years old, God knew that there would be issues that transcend one generation. And He addresses issues like that in this book, mostly in story form. One of these issues is the matter of life. Now, we don't typically take politicized issues and do standalone messages on different topics, but there are issues that are not really political issues, but rather they're biblical issues. And when we come across these important topics in the passages we are studying, then you know that I do not and I will not sidestep them. And here in this text, we have a life and death issue. These two Hebrew midwives, Shifra and Puah, whose desire to honor God far exceeds their fear of Pharaoh, they defy his orders to kill all the baby boys, and in an act of civil disobedience, they choose life over death. Now, we want you to know that the leadership of Fellowship Greenville chooses life over death. We believe it is a horrible tragedy that over a million babies are aborted in this country every year. Now, you got to please understand, I am not speaking politically, I'm speaking biblically here. The sanctity of life is a biblical issue. It is a spiritual issue. Now, I know at times specific circumstances can make this whole thing complex, and those things have to be talked about, but most often this is a very simple thing. Like in this story, Pharaoh decides that the boy babies had to die in order to protect the Egyptian way of life. Pharaoh chose to take life to preserve the choices of Egyptian life. Does that sound familiar? Our cultural problem is not much different. It's not that we don't value life. Our problem is that we value other things more than unborn life. In this story, you see, for Pharaoh, the lives of these baby boys was expendable because something else was more important. Now, in our country today, I pray that kind of thinking would change, that in the same way we seek to preserve the life of the born, that we would also seek to protect the life of the unborn. And it's my prayer that the hearts of people will change. It has to be the hearts of people. It's not going to be legislated and have it changed. People's hearts have to change. And this is interesting. I think a change does seem to be coming. I read recently a series of different surveys and polls that started back in 2003 and have run up through 2010. And these polls seem to indicate that more and more young people aged 20 to 30, both Christian and secular, now believe that most abortions are morally wrong, and they want stiffer limits on legal limits on abortion. And I pray, and I would ask you to pray, for more and more hearts to change. And I would also ask you to pray for ministries and organizations that help women think through their options, the options that they have. Organizations like Piedmont Women's Center, who is one of our strategic partners here in the Upstate. I have a short video I want to show you that kind of explains the services that Piedmont Women's Center offers.
So you just found out you're pregnant. What do? You may be scared, confused. You don't know who to turn to. It's going to be okay. There is help. There is a women's clinic nearby in the Upstate, and everything we do is free and confidential. Our all-female staff can assist you with free pregnancy tests, free limited OB ultrasounds, and counseling about your options. And we can also provide you with vouchers for many of the services you may need while you're expecting. If you or someone you know is facing an unplanned pregnancy, Piedmont Women's Center is here to help. Check out our website, or for more information, you can call 864-233-3823.
We want everyone in this room to know about Piedmont Women's Center and what they do, because it may very well be that God will bring someone across your path who needs guidance, looking for help, and if there's a need, then now you know which direction to point them. Now, I want you to hear this, and please don't miss this, because if you have had an abortion, we are so glad you're here. You are welcome here. So very welcome. God loves you, and so do we. God does not condemn you, and neither do we. We are seeking to be a community of grace, passionately pursuing life and mission with Jesus, and grace means that our arms are always open to anyone. And God is still writing His story in and through your life, and we're just very glad that you are worshiping with us and learning with the rest of us what it looks like to follow Jesus. So we're glad you're here. And one more thing, Piedmont Women's Center also offers a program that they call Abortion Recovery Assistance, which what this is their confidential, safe, non-judgmental studies for women and men who might struggle with different kinds of distress from past choices. And if that's something you feel like you could benefit from, I encourage you as your pastor to give them a call. Here's the number again. You can go online and contact them, PiedmontWomen'sCenter.org. I think this new round of studies starts September the 12th, but you can find that out online. All right. Choose life. What happens next in the story is you see that God dealt very well with the midwives because of the choice that they made. Verse 20, God dealt with the midwives well with them, and the people multiplied and grew strong, and because the midwives feared God, there it is again, He gave them families. So God blessed these women and the infant nation of Israel because of their choices, and in that day, midwives were normally single, childless women, and this text tells us that God blessed them and gave them their heart's desire, which was families of their own. But Pharaoh ramped up his campaign of death. Now, verse 22, then Pharaoh commanded all his people. So now he's going beyond the midwives, and he's telling all Egyptians, if you find anywhere a son, a Hebrew son, take that boy and cast him into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. He's determined to eradicate the Jewish nation from the face of the earth in a generation or two. Pharaoh's like, okay, you say the Hebrew boys are born before you can get there and kill them? Okay, everybody hear this. I want you to find, if you find any Hebrew boy, I want you to throw him into the river. Now, why kill the boys? Well, because the boys grow up to be men, fighting men. Fighting men who might side with Egypt's enemies to fight against Egypt. Well, why not the girls? Well, the girls grow up with no Hebrew men of marriageable age, and they have to intermarry with the Egyptians. And in a generation two, no more Israel, just but a whole lot more Egyptians. Now, as you know, it won't be the last time in history that a people group claiming to be the perfect, pure race tries to exterminate the Jewish people. But God is always at work, and he's going to make sure that doesn't happen. Now look at this. Now, if Pharaoh, the most powerful man on the face of the earth, if he wants you dead, then you have no hope, and that's a fact. But when you add God to the equation, fact now is changed by faith, because God says, these are my people, and I've made them a promise, and I will most certainly keep that promise, a promise that I have all the power that I need to keep. And now we're going to start to see how the power begins to manifest itself. But just it's slow to get started. Now things are going to get personal as we turn the corner to chapter 2. We peek inside a small brick home in the fertile land of Goshen. In chapter 6, verse 20, we find that it's a home belonging to a man named Amram and a woman married to a woman named Jochebed. And we see God preparing the way for the salvation of his people. Chapter 2, verse 1. Now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. And the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months. And when she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with tar and pitch. And she put the child in it and placed it among the reeds at the riverbank. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now, you got to play this movie in your mind here, because this is a heartbreaking scene. For 3 months, they tried to hide this child. For 3 months, they tried to do what every parent innately tries to do, and that is to protect their baby. But now the neighbors know about it, and the whole neighborhood knows about it. People are walking by, and they're hearing the boys' cries, and the troops of Egypt are making their patrols through the streets, and the cries come at the most inopportune time. So Jochebed tries to muffle the cries of her baby son, her son under a blanket, but it's gotten to the point where now the whole family is in danger. Father, mother, brother, sister, and Amram is saying, honey, we have to let the boy go. That we have to let the boy go. And she's struggling with this. The mother makes this basket. And again, I love the irony here, because in this text, the Hebrew word for basket is the exact same word that's used to describe the ark that Noah built in Genesis 6. The ark is not about how big the boat was. The ark was about who it saved. Not a big boat, but a saving boat. And this word ark is used only here and in Genesis 6. This mother built a little ark of bulrushes that would save her baby. She coated it with tar. She wrapped it, her baby, in a blanket, and she put him in that basket. And I can imagine before the fateful day comes that she's in the home and she's rocking that baby back and forth in that basket. And Amram, her husband, puts his hand on her shoulder and he says, honey, we've got to let him go. We've got to let him go. And she's like, no, just one more day. Let's wait just one more day. He says, but our whole family's in jeopardy. Do you want us all to die? Honey, we got to let him go. And that mom takes that boy down to the river, and she places him in the reeds beside the bank of the river. Now, if you have seen the animated DreamWorks movie, Prince of Egypt, I watched it this week, and you know what? It's a musical. It is a musical. Matt's over there like, yeah, like a musical. Are you kidding me? But anyway, so here's what happens in the movie. How many of you have watched the movie before? Okay, you know then that mother pushes that little boat out into the current of the Great Nile River, and it goes down the rapids, and then crocodiles are snapping at it, and hippopotamuses are thrashing about, and then the basket gets picked up in a fishing net, and it miraculously falls back down into the river, but then the boat almost runs it over, and the paddles almost crush it, and it's not biblical. Now, it's a great story, but it's just not biblical. No, what really happens is Jochebed puts her baby in a basket in the reeds beside the bank of the river at a strategic place, and she sends her daughter to stand at a distance to watch kind of as a spotter. I think she puts him in the river at just the right time and just the right place. I think she knows that just downriver, the Egyptian women have an appointment at Nile Nails and Spa, and I mean, it's their favorite bathing spot. The boat baby is not sailing down the river. He is set carefully, lovingly in the reeds of the on the edge of the river. So as these women walking along the river, then hopefully the basket, the baby, can be found. But the chances of someone finding this baby and not just throwing him into the water like Pharaoh had commanded are slim to none. Jochebed couldn't bear to watch. I think that's why she left her daughter there. I think Amram had to take her. He put his arm around her shoulder, and he squeezed her tighter than ever, and they started walking back to the house, and she's weeping every step, wanting to turn around and go back, but he won't let her go back. Every step, hoping and praying for a miracle to happen, and it does. Verse 5, now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river while her young women walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds. I think she probably said, "What's that over there? I think it's a crocodile. Servant girl, you go check it out." And servant girl goes and goes, "No, it's a basket." And she goes, "Okay, bring it back here." So when she opened up, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. And she took pity on him and said, "Oh, this is one of the Hebrew children. I mean, how can you resist this baby? I mean, you can't throw that baby into the Nile." So, verse 7, then his sister, who was slowly inching her way up the bank of the river, said to Pharaoh's daughter, just a thought, but should I go and try to find a nurse for you from among the Hebrew women? And Pharaoh's daughter says, "Yeah, that is a good idea. Go." And so the girl, Moses' sisters, went and called Moses' mother. I mean, you just can't make this stuff up. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this child away, nurse him for me, and I'll pay you." So the woman took the child and nursed him, and when the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son, and she named him Moses, which has both an Egyptian root and a Hebrew root, but it basically means, Moses means to draw out. She named him Moses because she drew him out of the water. Now, I tell you, this is a story that only God can start, and we're just getting started, because what happens next is in verse 11. Verse 11 says, one day Moses, when he had grown up, went out into where his people, own people were, and he's about 40 years old in verse 11. He was like a baby boy in chapter 10. Now he's 40 years old, but I want to fast forward through the 40 years, because what happens is, as a 40-year-old man, he kills a guy and has to run away, and he goes away from Pharaoh's palace, and he ends up being a shepherd out in the wilderness on the backside of a mountain. And as a shepherd, he goes and he sees this burning bush that doesn't burn up, but the bush is talking to him. And he's like, "What? You're kidding me. Oh, my." And the burning bush says, "I want you to lead my people out of Egypt." And Moses is like, "I can't lead. What are you talking about? I can't speak." And the voice says, "Take that staff in your hand and throw it on the ground." And he throws it on the ground, and it turns into a serpent. And then Moses is like, "Woo, that's awesome, that's awesome." And so Pharaoh says, "Go, go." Or God says, "Go." And so he goes, and now he's 80 years old. He's 80 years old, and he goes to the great Pharaoh and says, "You got to let the slaves go. I used to be one of them." And Pharaoh says, "Get out, don't come back." And he says, "Okay, plagues." And you got plagues of blood and plagues of frogs and flies and lice and locusts and boils and hail and darkness and death and plagues that come and just absolutely decimate Egypt. And finally, Pharaoh says, "Go, get out, just leave me." And they go, and the Red Sea parts, and the children of Israel go across on dry ground, and then the sea miraculously comes back over and kills all the Egyptian army, and that's an amazing story, but that's only the start. That's just the intro, because after that, Moses had to lead these boneheaded people who say, "Oh, we love God. Oh, but life is so hard. Let's go back and be slaves in Egypt." And God's like, I wish you would. And so Moses learns how to talk to God when things aren't going right. And what Moses has to do and what God has to do in your life and in my life when we don't see God, when we say we love God but we really don't want God, he's trying to get us to trust him rather than trust ourselves. And it's going to be a great story. And so I got to catch my breath here. Great story. But before we get there, there's these verses that I just read, and some of you are like, I just heard the next 16 weeks. I don't have to come back for a couple months. But before we get there, we need to see a very important truth, a big idea truth about God and the way he works that is absolutely essential that you factor in to what pops into your mind when you think about God. And that big idea is this, that God is always working to set us free, but he does so in very strange ways. God is always working, making himself known, working to set us free, but he does so in very strange ways. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, I just kind of hinted at it. The number one thing that God is doing in the world, what I say earlier, number one thing in your life and in my life, God is making himself known so we can be free to love him and trust him for who he really is and not for some God that we want to make up and try to force him to be. True freedom is not doing whatever you want, whenever you want, however you want, with whoever you want. True freedom is living out God's purpose for your life in a loving relationship with God and with other people. I love how Tim Keller puts it. He says it this way, until you are ravished by, bowed down in, astounded before the beauty and glory and the presence of God, you are not free, not free. He says unless you are serving the living God, unless he is the most important thing in your life, unless you're absolutely centered on him, you're a slave. Anything you center your life on more than God makes you a slave. Anyone who is not absolutely centered on God is a slave. And he says the whole book of Exodus is designed to subvert the idea that you can have personal and spiritual freedom apart from God and the way he works. To accomplish that, to set us free, is very strange, to say the least. Now, let's look at a couple of these strange ways that God works that surface in this passage. Strange way, number one. Number one, God uses difficulty and suffering to grow us and shape us into the kind of people who love him and trust him more than anything else. He uses difficulty and suffering to grow us up. To turn what's bad in our life into what is good. So here's the story starts. Everything is really good. Everything is really good. Here's the family of Jacob living in the best of the land. God's providing for them. He's protecting them. The land of Goshen was kind of like an incubator, like a greenhouse where this family is. Now, chapter 1, verse 5 says that they were being fruitful and multiplying and filling the land, which, by the way, the narrator uses those words because those are the exact same words that God gave Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. The significance of that being that God is birthing the nation of Israel in fulfillment of his creation mandate. He is creating a new redeemed humanity to whom he will be their God and they will be his people. But this fledgling nation, they can't grow strong. They can't really know God and trust God unless they know they need God, unless they know that they have to depend on him. And to do that, accomplish that, he's going to take them through great suffering. So Pharaoh, feeling threatened by the sheer number of these people, threatened by the very blessing of God, he says in verse 13 of chapter 1, so they violently made the people of Israel work as slaves, and they made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. Now, verse 14 describes what the slavery was like in Egypt, but our English translations refuse to translate it the way it literally reads. And the reason is because it's just so boring. But this is why the way the verse literally reads. They made their lives bitter with serving in brick and mortar and all kinds of serving in the field. And in all their service, they ruthlessly made them serve as slaves. You see, it does kind of sound boring when you translate it, but it's absolutely essential because, you see, The repetition is like the crack of a whip. Serve, 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 serve. That's what he's trying to get across in the language of the text. The repetition reminds us that this serving, serving, serving went on year after year, generation after generation, well over 100 years, which is a long time. It's a very long time, much harder to live than for me to talk about. Hour after hour, 14 hours a day, day after day, 7 days a week, weeks that flow into months, and months that fade into years, and years that fast forward into lifetimes and whole generations. Serve, 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 serve. That's what it was like. But verse 12 says that the more they were oppressed, the more they were blessed. So things go from bad to worse. The incubator becomes a furnace, and Pharaoh tells the midwives to kill the baby boys. And then he tells, when that doesn't work, he tells the Egyptian people to throw them into the Nile. Basically, it's not simply infanticide, it is genocide. But God is working to set them free. He's taking them through the most difficult times imaginable. And you know that's true because you know the rest of the story. That's why I fast-forwarded through the rest of the story. Because you know the rest of the story, then you can know that God is working in whatever difficulty you face. He is using the unbearable circumstance that you face, that you're facing, that you feel stuck in, to grow you into someone who loves him and trusts him more than anything else, because that is where true freedom is found. Strange way number two, God seems to be absent when we go through difficulty. In other words, when bad things happen, it's during those bad things that when God seems most silent and most absent, most distant. And the narrator of the story, he's a brilliant storyteller, but the way he makes this point, and you can really only going to get this point if you read all of chapter 1 and chapter 2 in one sitting. But when you read straight through chapters 1 and chapter 2, you see that God is hardly even mentioned. Chapters 1 and chapter 2 tell us that things get worse and worse and worse, and God's people are violently enslaved, and their little sons are being killed, and God is not mentioned except in relation to the midwives in verse 17 and 20, but apart from that, he's not mentioned. And I think it's brilliant because the narrator is drawing us in to the natural human response to suffering, and that is when we go through suffering, we're like, God, where are you? God, where are you? I pray, but I'm not hearing anything. I pray, and nothing's happening. Nothing's changing. Nothing's changing. And you can. It's a natural human response. You can see in the movie of your mind, you know, when all of this is set in motion, Egyptian troops are rolling through Hebrew towns, and they're dragging people out of their homes and putting them in chains, and they're killing people who resist. And no doubt, those people, during that 400-year period of slavery, they're like, God, where are you? What happened to the promises that you made to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob? What happened to all the good that we had? It's all bad. And as I said in chapters 1 and 2, covers generations. And the Exodus narrator, I think it's almost if he's saying to us, in your lifetime, you're not going to be able to see why some things happen to you or to those around you. There are things that are going to happen to you in your lifetime, and you'll never get a really good answer to that. Again, think about how many people died as slaves in those 400 years, never saw, never understood what God was doing or why God seemed to have abandoned his people. But we know, because we know the rest of the story, God had not abandoned them. So mark this down. Just because you can't see any good reason for the difficulty you're going through doesn't mean there can't be a good reason. Just because you can't see a good reason for the difficulty you're going through, that doesn't mean there can't be a good reason, because if you factor God into the equation, we know that God's ways are higher than our ways and his thoughts higher than our thoughts. And when you freak out because you think God's not there, when you think God's not doing anything, when you think he's distant or detached or uncaring or unloving or uninvolved, don't let the first sentences that pop into your head about God be sentences like, well, he doesn't care, he doesn't love me, he's not there, he doesn't see, he doesn't hear. No, remember this story. You know the rest of the story. That's why, again, I went through the fast forward, because what we see in this story is that every bad thing turns out for good. Every bad thing God will turn to good. And one of the great ironies of this story is that every bad thing that Pharaoh tries to do turns out to be good. Remember, he enslaves God's people lest they multiply, but they multiply anyway. He orders all the newborn babies to be killed, but two lowly midwives thwart his plan. Then he orders all the boy babies to be thrown into the Nile River, but Moses' mother, well, she follows his order, kinda. I mean, she puts her son in the river in a boat, but Pharaoh's own daughter defies her father's order, and Moses gets raised by his mother, in those early years, so he has a sense of his Jewish heritage. But then he gets educated in Pharaoh's own schools. He gets the best education in the land. He's educated to be a general. He's educated to be a great, great leader by Pharaoh himself. And you just go, oh my goodness. I mean, you're seeing this. I mean, Pharaoh is absolutely clueless, absolutely powerless. Everything he tries, every bad thing that he tries to do to God's people, ultimately God turns to the good of his people. So you see, God might be silent in these first two chapters, but he's definitely not absent. Never mistake God's silence for his absence, because you know the rest of the story. You know that God is working behind the scenes in ways you cannot see to set his people free. God's strange ways. He uses suffering and difficulty to grow us to be the people that he wants us to be. Number two, in those times of difficulty, it often seems like he's silent and absent, but he's always working in ways we can't see. Number three, God works through the weak and powerless, not through the strong and the powerful. God normally works through the weak and the powerless, not through the strong and the powerful. And you see that in this story in this way. How does God save the people? How does he save his people in chapters 1 and chapters 2? Well, all the heroes in the story are women. They're all women. Now, I mean, sorry, ladies, but back in the day, women had little or no status. But you have two midwives, Shifra and Pua, women with no children of their own, which would be they would have even less status, considered all but useless in that culture, except for the work that they're doing. And probably they're cursed by God. But they fear God more than they fear Pharaoh, and they save the Hebrew boys, and God blesses them, and get this. What is interesting to me is that these two women, these midwives, their names are preserved in God's book, and we don't even know the name of this evil Pharaoh. And commentators for 200 years have speculated who this Pharaoh is, but you know what? If God purposely refused to put his name in the book, I don't care who he is. All I care about is God says, look at these two women. I'm really proud of them. They're heroes. And then you come to chapter 2, and it's Moses' mother rather than his father that takes the lead in acting to save him. His sister, not his brother, who takes the lead in acting to save him. And then you have Pharaoh's daughter. She's a Gentile. She's an outsider, an ethnic outsider. But her compassion and her bravery to defy her father ends up saving God's people. So God uses a Gentile woman to save his people. Oh, hear me. Don't ever let anybody tell you that you're nobody. Don't you ever tell yourself that you're a nobody. It doesn't matter who you are or what you've done or haven't done. Look at this story. God uses nobodies to save his people. Weak people, marginalized people, outsiders. He used those people to set his people free. Very strange. Very strange. Okay, so listen. If you don't take anything away from this story except for this, know this, that God especially likes to work through people who have been told all their lives or who have told themselves all their lives that they're nobodies. But they're not nobodies to him. He knows their name. He knows your name. And he has a plan and a purpose for your life. And that to me is incredible. Okay, summary. God is always at work in our lives to set us free, but he works in strange ways. Sometimes he allows the very worst to grow us into the very best. People who love him and trust him more than anything else. Sometimes in those bad days, he seems silent and absent and distant. But we know in the story of the Bible, that is just not true. We know that God is working behind the scenes. And we also see that most of the time, he works to save us through weak and powerless rather than the strong and the powerful. And we know these things are true, again, because we know the rest of the Exodus story. But there's more to the story that goes way beyond Exodus. We need to look beyond the Exodus story if we're to truly be free to love God and trust Him more than anything else. Because you see, those principles, the three principles I just gave you, true as they are, they will not set you free. They're helpful, but they won't set you free. But in fact, it's worse than that. If you try to live out those principles just by telling yourself to try harder to get those things and those sentences in your head, those sentences can strangle you. We need more than principles. We need a person. And I want to quote Keller again with some of my own edits and additions. We need to look to the person to whom Moses points. What you need to do, Keller says, is to see Jesus on the cross, the ultimate place where the very, very worst turned out for the very, very best. The ultimate place where God seemed to be absolutely absent, totally absent. My God, why have you forsaken me? Yet in the cross, he says, God was doing the ultimate, the best thing he could possibly do for us. And he says, it's only when I see Jesus on the cross dying for me do I see that Jesus is really personally involved with the difficulties and sufferings in my life and the evil that I experience here in this world. It's only when you look to the cross and you see Jesus taking the very worst for us so that we could have the very best from God, it's only then that your freedom begins to materialize. It's only when you see on the cross that even though God seemed absent, that he was working again for our good, Jesus taking the bad. And then on the cross, you see Jesus hanging there, weak and powerless. But that's only half the story. That's only half the story. The cross was only half the story because it was Friday, but Sunday was coming. And Easter came, and forgiveness came, and life came, and grace came, and power came, and hope came, and freedom has come. It's not by practicing the principles of Moses that we find freedom. It's when we put our faith and trust in Jesus, the one to whom Moses pointed, that we can find this freedom.